they no longer can have hegemony over the world. We have to work on strengthening people's resistance all around the world in order to bring that future closer and make that future more justice-centered. So we need the people of Iran and the people of the Muslim world and the freedom fighters all around the world to understand that this is an important and a sensitive time in world history. It is a time that we have to once again remember, some of the most important figures in this anti-imperialist struggle. And I think the most important anti-imperialist personality in our time has been Imam Khomeini. And his legacy is important not just for showing to the world that our struggle has been justice-centered and we have been struggling on to overcome injustice in our country, but it is important to remember Imam Khomeini so that we can look to a more look forward to a more justice-centered future. We can hold hands together stronger, the people all around the world who, and of course, it is important to note that scholars are talking about decolonization of the very West have been responsible for all these injustices, over the past centuries. We are seeing the movements in the United States. We are seeing decolonial movements all around the Western world. People in the Western world are realizing and they are actually looking forward to a more just world. And, it is one of the most stark examples of it is the anti-Zionist movements that is spreading all around the world and including in the Western world. So we have to say at this point in time that Imam Khomeini has not died. He lives on, and we have to, capitalize on this personality, on his legacy for the future. We are not commemorating the past, but we are actually looking forward to a future that is more justice-centered. And of course, the people of Iran are under enormous pressure in order to put down this, the flag in order to, and they have shown time and again that they can and they have the power to withstand all these pressures and they understand their responsibilities at this time and they understand the importance of the revolution in this and, in this global anti-imperialist movement and struggle. As I said, the future is going to be bright if we understand the legacy of Imam Khomeini and use that in order to build on the struggles of the Muslims around the world and including the Muslims inside Iran and the freedom fighters all around the world.
Thank you very much. That was Hakima Biryam, Assistant Professor at Tehran University. We also had with us Syed Mustafa Khoshchashm, a political analyst who is a regular on Press TV. Thank you very much to both of you. Let's watch a short package about Imam Khomeini, the late Imam Khomeini.
Thank you. Sayyid Ruhollah Mousavi Khomeini was born in 1902 in the central Iranian town of Khomein into a family with a strong religious background. After World War I, young Ruhollah went to the city of Arak to study in its Islamic seminary. He was placed under the leadership of Ayatollah Abdul Karim Ha'eri Yazdi. The following year, Ayatollah Ha'eri Yazdi transferred to the Islamic seminary in the holy city of Qom and invited his students to follow. Khomeini's studies included Islamic law and jurisprudence. He was also drawn to the relationship between politics and religion, in particular the role of the clergy in politics. In his conversations with religious scholars and leaders, he raised the issue of saving Iran and safeguarding Islam. He believed the Iranian people needed to overthrow the ruling Pahlavi dynasty to be freed. Ruhollah Khomeini became a lecturer at Najaf and Qom seminaries, teaching political philosophy, Islamic history, and ethics. He soon became a leading scholar of Shia Islam, and his hostility towards Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, more commonly known as the Shah, began to receive wider attention. He became the main opposition speaker inside Iran, constantly attacking the monarch's brutality. He warned the Shah that if he didn't change, the day would come when people would offer up thanks for his departure from the country. Following these comments that prompted massive protests in Qom, Khomeini was arrested and exiled in June 1963. After spending 2 years in Turkey, he returned to Najaf in Iraq, where he continued his sermons as well as his attacks on the Shah, showing that exile could not silence him. His followers created a complex network in which they carried the tape recordings of his speeches to Iran, where new copies would be made and distributed in mosques throughout the country. Imam Khomeini became the face of the opposition to Iran's ruling elite, both inside and outside the country. The more influence and followers the scholar gained, the less secure the authorities in Tehran felt. Eventually, the Shah's government called for help and Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein, who expelled Imam Khomeini from the country. In October 1978, the Imam went to Paris and stayed in the town of Neufchâteau. At the time, the streets of Tehran were flooded by mass anti-Shah protesters inspired by Imam Khomeini. In January 1979, the Shah was forced to flee into exile. For the next 2 weeks, the country was preparing for the Imam's return to his country after 16 years. The world witnessed a historic event as an unprecedented crowd greeted Imam Khomeini on his return. Millions lined up in the streets chanting his name and followed his car as he went to Tehran's famous cemetery of Behesht Zahra, where he made his historic address. The revolution was complete. Sayyid Ruhollah Mousavi Khomeini was born in 1902 in the central Iranian town of Khomein into a family with a strong religious background. After World War I, young Ruhollah went to the city of Arak to study in its Islamic seminary. He was placed under the leadership of Ayatollah Abdul Karim Ha'eri Yazdi. The following year, Ayatollah Ha'eri Yazdi transferred to the Islamic seminary in the holy city of Qom and invited his students to follow. Khomeini's studies included Islamic law and jurisprudence. He was also drawn to the relationship between politics and religion, in particular the role of the clergy in politics. In his conversations with religious scholars and leaders, he raised the issue of saving Iran and safeguarding Islam. He believed the Iranian people needed to overthrow the ruling Pahlavi dynasty to be freed. Ruhollah Khomeini became a lecturer at Najaf and Qom seminaries, teaching political philosophy, Islamic history, and ethics. He soon became a leading scholar of Shia Islam, and his hostility towards Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, more commonly known as the Shah, began to receive wider attention. He became the main opposition speaker inside Iran, constantly attacking the monarch's brutality. He warned the Shah that if he didn't change, the day would come when people would offer up thanks for his departure from the country. Following these comments that prompted massive protests in Qom, Khomeini was arrested and exiled in June 1963. After spending 2 years in Turkey, he returned to Najaf in Iraq, where he continued his sermons as well as his attacks on the Shah, showing that exile could not silence him. His followers created a complex network in which they carried the tape recordings of his speeches to Iran, where new copies would be made and distributed in mosques throughout the country. Imam Khomeini became the face of the opposition to Iran's ruling elite, both inside and outside the country. The more influence and followers the scholar gained, the less secure the authorities in Tehran felt. Eventually, the Shah's government called for help and Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein, who expelled Imam Khomeini from the country. In October 1978, the Imam went to Paris and stayed in the town of Nouvelle-le-Château. At the time, the streets of Tehran were flooded by mass anti-Shah protesters inspired by Imam Khomeini. In January 1979, the Shah was forced to flee into exile. For the next 2 weeks, the country was preparing for the Imam's return to his country after 16 years. The world witnessed a historic event as an unprecedented crowd greeted Imam Khomeini on his return. Millions lined up in the streets chanting his name and followed his car as he went to Tehran's famous cemetery of Behesht Zahra, where he made his historic address. The revolution was complete.
So we're back with our special coverage of the 33rd anniversary of the demise of Imam Khomeini, the late founder of the Islamic Republic. To continue our discussion, so we have Tohid Asadi and Sarbaz Ruhullah Rizvi with us right now. And I would like to ask Mr. Asadi first about Imam Khomeini and, of course, what he could briefly tell us about who he was and what his legacy is.
Well, I was following your program, and Dr. Piria and Mr. Khoshesh referred to some critically important points regarding your question, and I'm going to follow up on that. Well, I think when we're talking about the Islamic Revolution and when we're talking about the founding fathers of the revolution and Imam Khomeini in particular, we're facing a quite unique and, let's say, innovative infrastructure, innovative architecture, and innovative personalities. And when it comes to Imam Khomeini, peace be upon him, it becomes even more unique and more innovative. So on that, I think several, of course, there is a wide spectrum of aspects that could be discussed. But to me, of course, there are three, four key points in this regard which makes Imam Khomeini unique and which makes his legacy quite extraordinary. The first one is, I think, the ability to pay close attention to the need for the sense of unity and the very notion of nation building that was lacked on that period of time. As you know, we confronted a society which was quite paralyzed, and Imam Khomeini's ability to mobilize a very immobilized society is unique in the sense that he could manage to gather all the people under one unique flag, and this is a very unique ability that could be paid close attention to. And the second aspect I think is his ability and his great mentality that resulted in a very special movement which was both retrospective and prospective. So it was quite unique in that it was retrospective in that it paid attention to the colonized background of the country, and it paid close attention to how people were fed up with the current situation on that period of time, and that people had this understanding, or with the assistance of Imam, they could come up with this understanding that as long as the country is under colonization and as long as the country does not enjoy an independent system when it comes to foreign policy, when it comes to domestic aspects, the result is not going to be a prosperous country. So on that basis, Imam could formulate this movement with this fact being considered that if they want to become a successful country, they need to gather under one flag and they need to pay attention to their past. But at the same time, the movement was quite retrospective, meaning that Imam had this extraordinary amount of intelligence to grasp this notion that if you start an independent movement against the mainstream discourse, against the, let's say, dominant centers of power on that period of time, then the result is going to be that, okay, they're going to all be against your country. And on that basis, we had a foreign policy in which a huge amount of emphasis was directed towards independence. And for the years down the road, Iran experienced this independent foreign policy in spite of all the negative, let's say, consequences, all the, let's say, attacks coming from the western side of the world and sometimes the eastern side of the world. Iran still kept that trajectory of foreign policy because there was this notion that as long as it's independent, it's going to result in a better situation. But again, another maybe unique aspect of this moment was that it was, as I mentioned earlier, it was a kind of new paradigm against the dominant discourse, the mainstream discourse all around the world. So the consequence was that even though many people, many nations started to closely follow what took place in Iran and started to have some sympathetic, let's say, notions and senses regarding the developments in Iran, it was predictable that the great centers of power, including the United States and other countries, were not going to like this movement because it's kind of deconstructed the conventional structures of power all around the world. And in spite of these pressures, and in spite of these pressures that was out there on that period of time and it started to increase, Imam Khomeini decided to keep this same trajectory. And after all these years and decades, we have came to this understanding that the amount of pressure is closely associated with the extent to which we try to keep and maintain our independence when it comes to foreign policy and when it comes to domestic policies. And one last thing that here I would like to mention is that the nature and the very quiddity of Imam Khomeini's intention behind leading this movement is quite different from all the conventional, actually, revolutions and movements that we see all around the world. So it does not come, it is not coming from a kind of hunger for power, but it comes from a deep and profound sense of responsibility to save the nation, to save the country, which is coming from the religious background that Imam Khomeini, in which Imam Khomeini was raised, and the same background was almost there, and it's not just related to the religious, let's say, segment of the society, but even for those people with less religious tendencies, when they were familiarized with this regional concepts and the extent to which the new leaders were thinking about developing a better society, gradually we saw that even among the less religious people, we saw this tendency that attracted their attention, grasped their notion, and make them support this movement. I think these are some parts, not all of them, but some parts of the unique aspects of Imam Khomeini's personality and the very personality of the Islamic Revolution.
Thank you very much. Mr. Rizvi, we heard Mr. Asadi discuss how Imam Khomeini was able to bring people from all walks of life together. Let's focus more on that and see how that led to a final outcome and actually the toppling of the monarchy.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Let me shift to another important aspect of the personality and the activities and what Imam did at from an international perspective, from a geopolitical perspective. Yes, Imam fought against the Shah regime inside Iran, and at the same level, he fought against the geopolitics that was going on at the West Asian region. For that, we have to understand the role that Imam played for the cause of Palestine and against the Zionist regime. We should understand the context in which Imam Khomeini came with the revolution. Of course, Imam, the one who was leading the revolution of the Iranian people, the one who was actually the spirit of the revolution of the Iranian people, what he was thinking and how he was analyzing the existence of the Zionist regime as a region. For that, we have to go back to the speeches, statements of Imam Khomeini years before 1979 revolution. So when we go through those sentences, those phrases, those statements, we understand how Imam was, you know, precisely understanding the main problem of the region, and how Imam understood what so many scholars, so-called, you know, professors and the expertise in the geopolitics of different countries at the West Asian region were not able to understand. That was Israeli regime and the creation of the Israel from 1948 by the support of the West, by the support of the United Nations, and specifically by the support of the United States of America, how it was going to change the geopolitics of the West Asian region. And Imam Khomeini was the person who was giving notice. He was who was actually trying to awake the people and awake the politicians at the same time, awake the people and the politicians years before the revolution, that let's understand what is going on in our region. And when Imam succeeded in this revolution and toppled the Shah regime inside Iran, at the same time Imam was able to stop the plan of the West for changing the geopolitics of the West Asian region. This is really important to understand how Imam stopped, how Imam actually disturbed the whole plan of the imperialist powers to stop their geopolitical change and the geographical change of the West Asian region by the creation of the Israel. For that, we need to understand that context. Interestingly, just 6 months before the February 1979, in which the Islamic Revolution succeeded, and you know the revolution was done by the leadership of Imam. If we go to the context of the of this region, we understand and we see the important event that took place just 6 months, less than 6 months before the revolution, was the Camp David Accords. The Camp David took place in 1978. It was in, if I'm not wrong, in September 1978, and it was a great, powerful signal to the whole political structures of the Muslim Arab countries of the region that let's stop confronting Israel. Let's stop fighting against Israel. Let's stop resistance against Israel. And the message was very powerful. The West was trying to convince all the political systems that at the West Asian region, that there is no more reason for, you know, resisting against Israel. Israel is the hegemon power of the region, and you have to obey and you have to accept. And this is what actually Anwar Sadat did by signing the Camp David Accord. And then traveling to Israel, going to Knesset, and delivering that lecture over there in Knesset. And just less than 6 months after the Camp David Accord, the revolution is taking place in Iran. And the most important and prominent slogan of this revolution at international level is, down with Israel. Let's stop deals with Israel. Let's be united together against Israel. Here Imam comes with two very important strategies. First of all, to accept and to believe in the legitimate right of the self-defense of the Palestinians, resistance, to legitimize actually the armed resistance against Israel, which so many countries, specifically after the Fourth Arab-Israel War, they were not daring to speak about at all. Imam spoke about that. Imam came very frankly that we have to support the resistance And armed resistance is a legitimate form of resistance against the Israeli occupation. So this is one strategy that Imam came very frankly to the point, talking about it very, not only talking about it, but also in practical policies of Iran supporting the Palestinians by arming them. This is what Imam did. And the second point that Imam, the second strategy that Imam came with to stop the policies of the Israeli regime and region was the unity among the Muslim nations. And this policy, the second policy, was against those countries who were leaning towards East, who were leaning towards East by that, I mean, USSR. And they were thinking that by believing and having ties with the East power, which was USSR, we may be able to confront the policies of the United States in supporting the Zionist regime, which ended in nothing, actually. The great example of that is Jamal Abdel Nasser, with his nationalistic, Arab nationalistic, leftist ideology. He came to confront Israel, but he was defeated, actually. In 1967 war, Egypt, the most powerful Arab army, was defeated by Israel because they were trusting on East. They were trusting on USSR. Imam came with the idea of let's trust in the people, let's trust in our own, people, in our own Islamic identity. Let's go back to the Islamic identity. We are all Muslims. 1 billion Muslims are living over there. You should be united. And Imam is coming in different speeches with this strategy of unity. Unity at the very beginning with the Muslims, and of course after that with all freedom seekers of old, all the free men of old, can be united for the cause of Palestine. So these two were really important strategies. First of all, again, repeating, to legitimize the right for self-defense, the armed self-defense of the Palestinians, and supporting them. And the second, to invite for a unity among all the Muslims across the globe. So by these two strategies, actually, Imam Khomeini disturbed the whole plan of the Western imperialist powers in the West Asian region, that they were trying to make the hegemon power of the region the Zionist regime.
Sarbaz Ruhollah Rizvi, peace activist and commentator, joining us live from Qom. Thank you very much. Back to Mr. Tohid Asadi. Mr. Asadi, we just heard Mr. Rizvi elaborate on the importance of unity, particularly among Muslims, emphasized by Imam Khomeini. Can you help us understand why Imam Khomeini placed so much importance on unity among Muslims and, of course, discouraging any kind of divisions among Muslims?
Well, I think as your previous guest properly mentioned, emphasis on paying attention and close attention to the oppressed and suppressed people in Imam Khomeini's foreign policy behavior from a kind of extended mentality and mindset that existed for Imam Khomeini, which stems back from the Islamic mentality, which is behind the whole policy formulation of the revolution. So on that, there are a few points that I would like to touch upon in brief. First and foremost, the truth of the matter was that Imam Khomeini's foreign policy, not only regarding the Muslim communities, but also pertaining to the entire world, was not to gain favor of superpowers, but the focus of attention was the nations and the suppressed nations in particular. That is one point that could separate Imam's trajectory of foreign policy from most of other leaders in the world. And the second point is that when we're talking about Imam's mentality in foreign policy, we have to understand that it is at the same time very much pragmatic and very much like a new paradigm in which there is serious and strong tendency towards serving national interests, but at the same time, national interest is not all. So here, we see that what makes this foreign policy pretty much unique is paying attention to the moral codes, which again, as I mentioned earlier, stem back from the Islamic mentality and notion that was out there in the foreign policy behavior of Imam Khomeini. And another point which could be associated with how Imam dealt the Islamic community, the Muslims, and again, other communities, is the interactive nature of the foreign policy that Imam followed, in which we know that there are several instances for when, for instance, he wrote to Gorbachev. We saw that he was quite interactive, he was quite innovative. And that's I think, a fourth point or another point that highlights the foreign policy of Imam Khomeini, in which he not only hit the new road in the arena of communicating and interacting with other countries, but also he tried to show the way, show the proper way of how international relations could be formulated to other leaders. And there we see a huge amount of courage that Imam Khomeini shows on that period of time. So all in all, I think as your other guest mentioned, when we're talking about the foreign policy of Imam Khomeini and how he interacts with Muslim communities, what outstands and what tops the list of priorities is how he put the rights of people at the very center of foreign policy, regardless of the negative consequences that this kind of approach could bring. And he was courageous enough to follow this for several years down the road. And as we see, even when we're talking about the current foreign policy of the Islamic Republic, this is the trajectory that has been followed over more than four decades.
So, Mr. Tohidi, as you mentioned so yourself, Imam Khomeini is one of the most influential figures of the 20th century. One of the key legacies of Imam Khomeini is International Quds Day. Tell us more about that and how and why the Palestinian cause is at the heart of Imam Khomeini's teachings.
I think this particular instance is very much similar to other decisions that was made by Imam, and this comes from how important the role of people and the right of people and the right of Muslim people was important to him. And when it comes to the Palestinian issue, of course, if you just take a look at the very broad context on that period of time, you will easily understand that the Israeli regime was quite connected with the superpowers. And even when it comes to Arab countries, of course, as I told you before, when we're talking about the dichotomy of national interests and, let's say, concepts like freedom, concepts like independence, there are sometimes these paradoxes among nations. And some Arab countries, some Western countries, they decided, and they still keep this decision, to keep quiet and say nothing about this very brutal nature of the Israeli regime against Palestinian people. They attacked the sovereignty of an independent country. They started to take their lands. And when it comes to other countries on that period of time, okay, they would say, we might be not that much fine with that, but if we talk about it, it's not going to serve our national interest, considering the intricate nature of international relations. So we'd better not to take that cost and leave it for others. Imam Khomeini, on that period of time, understood that there are several causes, and I think what tops this, let's say, causes was this religious notion that they have to do something with that. But in addition to that, I think it comes from a very profound geopolitical understanding of how dangerous Israelis' courses of action could be for the future of Islam and for the future of Islamic countries. So on that period of time, he started to, let's say, do all he could in order to, let's say, show resistance, not only in words, but also in practical steps that he took. And the attempt was to, one of actually key aspects of this attempt was that Imam uniquely used this Palestinian cause to, first of all, go against the oppressive nature of the Israeli regime. And the second one, the second aspect is that it could be like a kind of engine or a kind of, let's say, reason or cause for gathering together the Islamic community for one unique cause. And that was a key contribution that Imam made.
Thank you very much, Mr. Asadi. We have with us Mohammad Marandi, professor of Tehran University. Thank you very much, professor, for joining us. Mr. Asadi elaborated on the importance of Quds Day and, of course, the Palestinian cause being at the heart of Imam Khomeini's teachings. Now, I would like you to elaborate more on these teachings to be a source of resistance for movements, especially independent movements in the region, particularly opposing foreign military intervention.
I'd like to stress that Imam Khomeini, I think, first and foremost, struggled against the colonization of the mind. We lived in a world where we had, on the one hand, capitalism, liberal capitalism, and on the other, we had communism. He believed that he must, and the model for emancipation does not have to be either the Western bloc ideology or the Eastern bloc ideology. And he believed that the model that was most appropriate for liberation, and of only the liberation of the mind, but the liberation of society, was Islam. He used the model of the Holy Prophet, who rose up against injustice, against a society where women were considered worthless, where the poor and downtrodden were slaves to the elites. And that was the same route that was later pursued by the first Imam, Imam Ali, when he came to power. And even before then, he struggled for the downtrodden, the oppressed, the poor. He tried to create a society where the powerful, the wealthy, were not the ones who dictated terms to the rest of society. They were not the ones who push society wherever they wanted to. And then, of course, the model of the Imam in Karbala, Imam Hussein, where he stood up against oppression and sacrificed his life and the lives of those around him. So this was the model that he used to create an extraordinary awakening among Iranians, which ultimately led to the fall of the Shah, who was basically a tool in the hands of the Western Empire. And since then, we've seen this struggle between Iran and between the resistance, this growing resistance that has spread beyond Iran's borders and has influenced so much of West Asia and even beyond, a struggle between this resistance and the Western Empire, an empire that has for centuries oppressed peoples across Asia, Africa, and the Americas. So I think the most important element here is not the actual physical struggle, but the struggle to liberate people from the chains of Western domination, the minds of people who thought or believed that the only mode of thinking, the only valid mode of thinking, is that which comes from the West, whether it is Marxism, which is a Western mode of thought, or liberal capitalism, which is again a Western mode of thought. He believed and he was confident that Islam, which was indigenous to the population of West Asia and again in much of the world, that it had enough to satisfy the needs of the people, to bring about that liberation, to bring about a sense of dignity and honor among people which was non-existent beforehand, to make people believe that they are empowered and that they have a responsibility to liberate not only a society against foreign oppression, but also against the imbalances and the hierarchy where the rich and the privileged get to have the major say in society. Whereas in his view, in his worldview, in the worldview of Imam Khomeini, he prioritized the downtrodden and oppressed over everyone else, over the rich and wealthy. And for him, the responsibility of the state was to focus on that segment of society rather than on those who were benefiting from the private sector and who would accumulate or could accumulate great wealth.
So, Professor, what do you think freedom-seeking nations could learn from Imam Khomeini?
I think it's this learning process has already begun. The spread of this ideology can be seen across West Asia and in parts of North Africa. We see how the Western Empire, which had really dominated the world after the collapse of the Soviet Union, this Western Empire, this universal empire, had crushed all opposition, except for a few small centers of resistance or nodes of resistance. All resistance was gone. And this Western Empire, in the name of humanity, was basically creating a Eurocentric model where the downtrodden across the globe, and even in the West, were at the service of the elites. And perhaps the most important node of resistance was Iran. Many believed that Iran would collapse under the weight of this power in the 1990s. Those who lived through that era remember the overwhelming power of the United States. At that time, it was called a hyperpower. People recall, those who are older recall, how easily the United States was to impose its will upon the international community. And, for example, in the case of Iraq and Afghanistan, was able to sweep in and destroy all resistance, for good or for ill, right or wrong. Then the United States, when it imposed its will upon the Iraqi people, killing 1 million people after a decade of sanctions where it killed another 1 million people, all against international law, people thought that there was nothing that could be done in future to block the United States. But the Islamic Republic of Iran, based upon that model of resistance, based upon that model which was founded upon the Quran, the Prophet, Imam Ali, Imam Hassan, Imam Hussein, and the Imams, that model of resistance was steadfast. It remained intact. Despite all the problems that we see in this country, the shortages, the many injustices, the shortcomings that exist, it's quite extraordinary to see that under such pressure and under such hostility, where hundreds of media outlets are funded by 40 different countries, over 40 different countries in one way or another, online armies, terrorist organizations, massive campaigns against the country, sanctions, terrorism, the assassination of senior government officials, dirty wars in Syria, Iraq, and elsewhere. when one looks at the sheer amount of hostility and all that has been thrown at Iran or the Islamic Republic of Iran and the resistance at large, whether in Lebanon and Yemen and elsewhere, it's fascinating and extraordinary to see how, despite all that, this movement, this ideology, this belief has been able to continue to expand. And at the same time, we are seeing, while this belief and this ideology and this group or this broad resistance is growing, we see how the Western Empire is literally collapsing before our eyes. We see how the United States and its allies are incapable of overcoming its antagonists. They're incapable of meeting the demands of their own population, despite having taken the wealth of continents for themselves for three centuries, despite the accumulation of wealth, the illegitimate accumulation of wealth for 300 years, destroying Africa, destroying so much of Latin America, destroying Asia to accumulate wealth. We see that this empire is on the verge of collapse. Yet the resistance, despite the hardship, continues to grow, despite its own shortcomings, continues to grow. And I think that that says and that reveals that Imam Khomeini was indeed a unique person, not only in our era, but in the past centuries.
That actually, Professor, is a very important issue you just mentioned. We talked to our correspondent, Yusuf Jalali, who was at Imam Khomeini Mausoleum, and we could see a lot of young people attending the ceremony. So if you could please elaborate on how this expansion that you talked about and how Imam Khomeini's views transcends generations, what exactly is the reason for this to go on?
We live in a world where one small area has traditionally ruled the whole of the so-called international community for centuries. For centuries, they colonized, and then we had neocolonialism, and even after governments became independent across the global south, they were still dominated by the West and the Soviet Union as well. But the West was the greater power. Both of these ideologies were basically from the West. Both of these ideologies stemmed from Europe. And both of them were historically colonialist. Marxism, Karl Marx himself, justified the colonization of India, because he said that basically his argument was that the global South was backward, that the global South was less civilized and less capable of self-governance, incapable of self-governance, in fact. And so it must therefore accept colonialism so that the West could push it forward. So this was the mentality that existed, whether in communism, in socialism, in capitalism and liberalism, these Western ideologies. It was a Eurocentric world. But what we saw in Imam Khomeini was something that could be uncomprehended across the global South. Resistance to this hegemonic and truly evil mode of thought or modes of thought, which prioritize one set of human beings against another. Even when we look at specific examples of resistance, such as South Africa and the struggle against apartheid, the reason why Europe and the United States supported apartheid, they supported the racist regime in South Africa, whereas the Islamic Republic of Iran and other resistance countries across the globe, whether in Latin America or in our part of the world, they supported the resistance was based upon this divide where the West saw itself as superior, as exceptional, as above and beyond the rest. And the sad thing is that this power, this sheer power of the West, brought about the colonization of the mind in much of the elites across the world. In our own country, many elites, consciously or otherwise, have traditionally saw the West as morally superior, as more capable. And it is that those very same chains that bind these intellectuals that prevent a society from moving forward, that prevent a nation from achieving true liberation. Because unless the chains that prevent us from seeing clearly, unless our minds are liberated, there's no way for a country to become truly liberated and independent. There's no way for a community of people or for nations to break the chains, the physical chains of Western hegemony. So again, I stress that the first and foremost act that Imam Khomeini did was that he broke the chains that made us intellectual slaves to the West for a large segment of society, and that included the youth. Not all youth. Many people across the world are still bound and chained to this dominant mode of thought and are dismissive to anything other than that, because they too see the rest of the world, including themselves, as somehow inferior to others. But for many, those chains are broken.
And now, Professor, with those chains broken, how do you predict the future of world order to change and develop, and how much of that could be attributed to Imam Khomeini and his teachings?
I think that the global world order has already collapsed. We are moving towards a new phase in humanity, a very dangerous phase. Not that the old